There will be spoilers ahead. Lots of spoilers, so be careful, won't you?
Max, what are you doing? You're supposed to be starting the show.
Yeah, hang on. I've almost got the big showstopper number figured out.
Huh?
Okay, look. I know this sounds nuts, but we're doing the series Be Like the Core Man, right?
Right.
And this week's movie is Little Shop of Horrors, right?
Right.
Well, I got inspired to... Now, hear me out. Write a musical based on the movie.
Max...
No. Listen. I know it sounds crazy, but I think it could really work. Get this. The plant sings. Seymour sings. Audrey sings. Everybody sings. Maybe the dentist gets his own number. I'm not sure.
Max!
Okay. A singing dentist is dumb. You're right. But I still think...
Max!
What?
Someone already did a Little Shop of Horrors musical.
What? Oh, man, did it just come out? Did I miss it? I totally missed it.
It came out over 40 years ago.
Oh. Well, it can't have been all that popular if I don't remember it.
Yeah, and there was a movie, and it was nominated for 2 Oscars, and it made over $40 million.
Oh. Ah. I see. Okay. No problems, only opportunities. Wait, did they do it as an all-rap show? Because I could totally
get something.
Okay, fine. Stop all over my dreams. Again! So, whatever. This is Max Mike Movies. I'm your host, Max. My heart is a desert of shattered glass, Levine. And that jerk over there is Mike I Hate Joy and Laughter Loose. You have any more darkness you want to spread to the souls of children, Mike?
I do hate joy and laughter.
They're actually the names of a couple of poodles who used to harass Mike.
They're cops!
Joy and laughter, they're cops.
This week.
But before we get to this oeuvre, we have our poll question.
Poll question.
We asked you, what is your favorite decade for filmmaking? If you look closely, which decade has most of your favorites and why? Val Coons, supreme overlordress of Q footsteps.
Overlordress.
Why not? Says, wow, that's a tough one. I'm going to go with the 70s, as 2 of my top 3 movies were made then. What's Up, Doc? And Airplane. Mm. Yes, I know Airplane was released in 1980, but it was shot in 79, so it counts. We'll allow it.
Sure.
Yep. Yes, you can continue to feel that. You are allowed.
Max
We're
Mike
that
movies.
Powerful.
Max Mike Movies, giving permission for your emotions since 1973.
Yep. There was a lot of experimenting in the 70s with color, with storytelling. The decade brought us the first blockbuster, Jaws, and lots of big-budget, multi-star films like The Poseidon Adventure. Not perhaps the best example.
See our entire episode on The Poseidon Adventure.
Then there were the ones that were so darn good, they're still considered some of the best of all time. Godfather, Chinatown, The French Connection. Okay, that's a pretty solid point right there, Val. Thank you. We have a new writer in, Degsy O'Brien, who has, to my mind, taken over the spot from Derek Steele as person with a name most like a literary character.
Oh, yeah.
I'm telling you, Degsy O'Brien, I can see it. He was a poor Irish lad who grew up to be a famous landscape painter, and now he solves crimes.
Yeah, I'd watch that show.
See? Just you wouldn't need anything else. Just the title could be Degsy O'Brien. That's
just Degsy.
Degsy. Oh, that'd be good, too.
Yeah, by Quinn Martin.
Quinn Martin production. Degsy says, I lean heavily toward the 70s. There you go, Val. You got support right off the bat.
Ooh.
Because of my age, watching so many of them as a child at the theater and drive-in, both great and not so great, Star Wars, Poseidon Adventure. I assume that's one of the not so greats there, Degsy. Moonraker, Exorcist, Cannonball Run, many Disney live-action works. And then later, as an adult, going back to more adult-focused movies like The Godfather, Raging Bull, Taxi Driver. I miss old-fashioned film stock. I could watch a 70s film more easily than some 90s or aughts works.
Hmm. Neat.
Nice. That's entering the game with a solid hit there.
Thank you, new listener.
Hmm. Brian Mundo says, what decade was The Fifth Element made? The 90s! You and your Fifth Element, Brian!
He loves that movie. I mean, to be fair, it is a pretty fun movie.
It is a lot of fun. I have no fire.
Corbin! There's a connection. Oh,
there is!
The Corbin.
The Corbin. I know,
it's Corbin, not Corman, but here you go.
Yeah, yeah. It's awfully close. Nick Hoffman says, I'm conflicted, honestly. Hi, conflicted. We're Max Mike. Damn it! Sorry.
Fired.
I'll see myself out.
Good. Oh, bumpy.
I'm conflicted. Yeah. Oh, yeah, so you'll have to hurry to catch it before the glue factory. I'm conflicted, honestly. On the one hand, the 30s were chock full of my favorite swashbucklers. Errol Flynn alone had all of his best there, not to mention Bogart classics. On the other, if you'll allow me a tweak, all right, you may have a tweak. The period of 1975 to 1985 is just an outstanding 10 years. To be fair, that is a decade. It's not. It's just not a contiguous one.
Sure. I mean, it with is. It's just not. It doesn't. Never mind. We know what we mean.
Yeah. Yes. Now, with Spielberg's first burst, Lucas's original SW trilogy.
SW.
Southwest.
I must have missed that
okay.
one. Oh, well.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Rocky, Network, Taxi Driver, all in 1 year. Dang, forgot that. Raiders, still a perfect movie, if you ask me. Let's not forget Star Trek, Terminator, Eddie Murphy, Animal House, The Blues Brothers, and finally one of my picks for top five of all time, Amadeus.
Oh.
Huh.
Hmm.
Okay. And the crazy thing is, I've missed a bunch. Hmm. Yeah, probably.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Dave ho ho writes, I thought I wrote a comment like that, like Nick's praised the 30s, but it doesn't seem to have been posted. Oops. Marx Brothers, Thin Man, Fred and Ginger, not Fred and Barney, plus serious fare like M and Rules of the Game, and Escapist, Snow White, Wizard of Oz. For Japan, I said 65 to 75, another half, sort of half decade to half decade, because that is when they shook off the shackles of pre- and post-war censorship. Movies got more political and more artistic as directors who had something they wanted to do and or say took the helm. The economy boomed and inhibitions went by the wayside, sometimes to awesome effect, sometimes horrific.
Gojira versus Smog Monster. Save the Earth.
Stop it. Stop it. Somewhere Vince has started dancing. The 40s are screwed up because of the war. The 50s are uninspired but have some gems. And by the late 60s, we get the whole let's cater to the boomers distortion that limits subject matter and focuses ever more often on doing what worked last time, rinse and repeat. Wow.
Huh.
That is a very interesting summary of about 50 years of movies.
Yeah. Maybe he should have a podcast.
Shut up. We don't need the competition.
Yeah. Since there's still only 10.
Yeah, yes. Roland, the headless Thompson Gunner Hardy, says, I'm with Nick with the film noir of the 40s and 50s are my faves. However, the movies of Spielberg and Pollock? Pollock? Sidney Pollock. Oh, yeah. I was thinking, Jackson Pollock made movies.
He was in one very briefly, yeah.
During the 70s and 80s are some of the best ever made. Yeah, that's fair. Adam Mark starts off with a quote, we taught the world new ways to dream, from Sunset Boulevard.
Mm.
It's hard to answer a favorite decade. Film styles and trends don't always fit neatly into 10-year increments. well, if you're going to be nitpicky, if I had to pick, I would say the 1930s, or more specifically, the crash and the end of until the end of World War II. I love the snappy dialogue, boundless optimism juxtaposed against the dark underworld and the social mores and customs on display that are just so completely removed from our own modern 2024. Movie crowds flocked to cinemas during this time period to escape the Depression and World War II for a few hours, and Hollywood delivered. Each film just presents such a feeling of possibility. The cynicism and snideness that typifies so much of American cinema today is just absent. Favorites? King Kong, 1933. It Happened One Night, 1934. The Thin Man, also 34. Stage Door, 37. A Star is Born, 37.
Well, one of them.
Mr. Smith, one of them, I think the first one. Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, 39. Wizard of Oz, 39. Rebecca, 39. Grapes of Wrath, 40. Citizen Kane, 40. And Casablanca, 41. Good Lord, I never really put all of those in a line like that. Mm. The rising stars of immortal greats like Mae West, Betty Davis, Marlena Dietrich, Jimmy Stewart, Jean Harlow, Clark Gable, Humphrey Bogart, Lauren Bacall, on and on. Every film genre draws its roots from the 30s. Musicals, rom-com, film noir, horror, big-budget action flicks, on and on. Long before CGI, every special effect feels special. And they all look like they're having just such fun doing it. We now know about the horrors of the repressive studio system and the rank sexism, racism, homophobia, and unhealthy, unsafe working conditions of that era. But what a treat that we can still enjoy so much. After the war, everything is just derivative. Fight me! That's what he says. Fight me.
Okay. So, hey, yay wow. for suffering. At least we get to still enjoy our movie. Whee!
Yes.
This goes back to that question I had a couple weeks ago, but yeah. Cool.
Charles Forsyth says, I'll narrow it down to a year.
What?
1999. Oh, right, when the moon exploded.
Yeah, September 13th.
Yeah, yep. Now, I could pick the decade in which the most classic films came out, or the decade where I think the best film or films came out, but 1999 produced the largest number of films that I've watched multiple times and would gladly watch again.
Hmm.
They're not all the best, or necessarily classics, but this is about my favorites. So here's my list of favorite movies from one single year. Now I will try to read as many of them as I can, because Charles gives us over 30.
I'll pick some of the best ones.
Okay. Office Space. Mm. Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels. Mm. The Matrix. Mm. The Mummy. Notting Hill. Mm. South Park. Bigger, Longer, Uncut. American Pie, although it hasn't aged well. The Blair Witch Project. The Iron Giant. Mystery Men. The Sixth Sense. Bowfinger.
Really? Yeah.
The 13th Warrior.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I like that film a lot.
The Muse, Stir of Echoes, American Beauty, Three Kings, The Limey, Fight Club. You can go and fight Adam.
Don't talk about that.
The Straight Story. Yeah, that's right. Sorry. Broke the first rule. Being John Malkovich, Malkovich. Princess Mononoke, Dogma, Toy Story 2, The Cider House Rules, The Green Mile, Magnolia, Man on the Moon, Galaxy Quest. And, of course, we can't forget The Phantom Menace, although we continue to try.
Yeah. Wow.
The list doesn't even take into account many acclaimed films that I haven't seen yet, like The Thomas Crown Affair and Eyes Wide Shut.
Mm.
Wow. 99 was quite a year.
See, our first episode ever on Eyes Wide Shut and later on Thomas Crown Affair, and quite honestly, about six other films from that list. All in 99. What else did we do that year?
Not much. Cripes. Jeez. I think we spent the whole year at the movies.
Yeah.
Richard, yes, I did invent the Tatum.
There
shut up, Mike.
Is
Tatum.
No such thing. Stop it.
You couldn't cut me off. Dear God, what a question. I don't have one. I love movies from the whole swath of the film era. That's perfectly fair.
Pat him on the head and send him to bed.
He is not a who.
Oh. Is he a what?
No, but our favorite Canuck.
Mm.
From up in the Canucks, who always gets his mouse, Vince tells us, my favorite film era is a little undefined. Welcome to the club. The mid-20s to the late 30s. Hey, we've already had a couple of people who used two decades. Have the most film I really go for and admire, I think. I love black and white, shadows, and all the innovation taking place that gave us cinema as we know today. Wow.
That's early. That's before the talkies.
Yeah. That's before them talkies.
He must like to go to the flickers.
So So what about you, Mike? What is your favorite era for films?
It's a toss-up. So we did that series a while back on the 90s, which was very surprising because we just didn't remember what came out when. And we thought the 90s was sort of the beginning of, let's just rehash this, let's rehash that. And it ended up being really quite eye-opening, and it had a lot of great stuff. But I think I'm going to go with the 80s. There's a lot of films that came out in the 80s that we unfortunately are in some ways still seeing, but which at the time were different and really challenged, in some cases, the audiences. One of my favorite films, top three films ever, Blade Runner, came out in 1981. And it was I think it's a great film, as long as you watch the right version without the overdub, because it's stupid.
Yeah.
We got things that would become franchises. We get Terminator. We get the Highlander. We get all sorts of stuff that it felt like Hollywood was still willing to make room for lower budget, more experimental, even if mainstream films. And, you know, quite honestly, that's probably one of my prime movie-going decades was the 80s, because I was, you know, coming out of high school, going into, college. That didn't last. And just that was a very formative time for me, and I'm sure a lot of people choose based on that, although quite a number of our friends chose the 30s, which can't be that formative, because that's before their time. So I just think... I think it's before things got too out of hand, before everything was a franchise or a sequel, and we had some stuff that would come out that's just like, what about this? And we were like, yeah, what about that? And it was still fun to go to the films every week if possible. How about you, though? This is my question, so what do you think?
I'm a little more on Richard's side. I have a lot of trouble picking a single era. Also, there's eras for different types of films. For, like, comedies... I like the 30s and 40s. Marx Brothers, the screwball comedies, all those. I like the old film noirs from the 40s. But for science fiction, I like the 60s and 70s, where they were getting experimental and daring and trying stuff nobody had ever done before. And then you had the rise of the superhero movies in the 2000s, which I really I was really impressed with the early Marvel MCU movies.
Yeah.
Yeah. We will, the less said about the later, the more recent ones, the better. So I can't answer it. I don't have a favorite era. I in fact often have trouble remembering what year movies came out or what era they're, what specific era some of them are from.
You have trouble remembering your name.
Not since I had it written on my socks.
As long as you can remember socks, you're okay.
Well, I wear them on my hands,
socks,
so I
Mike
always
movies.
See them.
Has a certain ring to it.
That's right. I want to thank you all for your answers. Speaking of answers, I do want to give an apology to Matt Reisman, who answered our poll question of a couple of weeks ago about whether you like to see the making ofs and the behind-the-scenes stuff about movies. Oops. And I missed it completely. I just totally missed his answer, so we're going to read it now. Matt Reisman said, I used to. For context, my father was a professional magician when I was growing up. I always saw how the trick was done and enjoyed knowing the secrets. I appreciated the artistry behind the magic. I think that carried over into movie magic. I loved seeing how the makeup, props, and effects were created. I enjoyed the juxtaposition of the fantastic and the mundane. I also always liked the shorts, specials, and documentaries about how animated films were made. But I find this harder to come by. I find this joy harder to come by with CG-heavy films. I understand that the industry just calls these effects shots rather than special effects, and that rings true, even if it isn't accurate. It's not that I think there's less artistry behind computer animation and effects. I know how hard it is to make and a good-looking digital model. How hard it is to make a good-looking digital model. It's just that I don't really enjoy seeing how it is done. Maybe it's a problem with presentation, but it doesn't feel like there's any magic.
I can see that. We have a similar background, although it's his father who is a professional magician.
It was you. You were a magician.
If you were trying to be kind, yes. Pull
he went,
things.
You went under the stage name of Chris Angel.
I didn't ever.
Yes.
No.
Well, no, but you are a mind freak.
I did pull things out of other things and
We don't need to know about that.
It was magical, let me tell you. But I think that that mindset of going from one side of the stage to the other, either you originally had that interest in knowing how things were done, or once you got a taste of it, that kind of changes your way of thinking, and so you're keen to find out. So I get that totally. So sorry we missed it first time around. We always appreciate answers.
Yep, that was totally on me. Sorry, Matt. Okay. But you too can have your answers ignored if you would just answer our next poll question. I'll really try to catch all of them.
Or
again.
They'll be slapping.
And yep. And this question, which may have been very, very slightly influenced by this week's movie. Is there a movie adaptation you've seen that's actually better than the source material? If so, which one?
But how can they tell us?
I'm not going to tell you. It's a secret. Unless you feed me.
Oh, dear. Just go to the trivia.
The facts. Budget. Well, this being Roger Corman, it was whatever they found in the couch cushions. No, it's actually... this is a kind of a challenging question this week. What the actual budget was isn't exactly known. It was somewhere between $22,000 and $28,000. Although some people have claimed it went as high as $100,000.
I disagree.
you also have to understand it was hard to tell with Corman's budgets because very often the studio wouldn't give him any more money, so he'd just go, okay, I'll pay for this.
Oh.
And he didn't necessarily record that.
I don't think he did that this time.
No, I don't think he did. Well, ooh, giving it... Oh, spoiler!
Oops!
It's also almost impossible to find out what the box office was because this movie was never released by itself.
No, of course not.
This was literally a B movie in that it was released as a second feature with two different movies. First was Black Sunday. And then a year later with Last Woman on Earth, another winner.
Oh, dear.
This movie, now, Corman is famous for his short shooting schedules. This one is his record. It was shot in 2 days and one night.
2 days?
Yeah. 72 hours it was shot.
Okay.
Now, it was rumored that the film's shooting schedule was based on a bet that Corman made that you couldn't do a film in 2 days.
I believe
now,
you.
Now, this claim has been denied by Mel Wells, a.k.a. Gravis Mushnick. According to Jackie Joseph, who played Audrey, Corman shot the film quickly in order to beat changing industry rules that would have prevented producers from buying out an actor's performance in perpetuity. On January 1st, 1960, new rules would go into effect that basically meant the producers had to pay all the actors residuals for all future releases of their work.
What?
Yeah. It meant you'd have to keep paying for the actors for the movie they were in.
But that's an outrage.
I know. Ludicrous, right?
Actors,
almost like the actors were, I don't know, important to the movie.
Or people deserving of retribution.
Retribution. Well, some of them in this movie are kind of deserving of retribution.
Now who's giving it away?
Yeah. So basically, Corman decided to shoot one last film before the rules went into effect, and he did it in the last week of December 1959.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, that's...
Now, Corman did not believe that this movie had much in the way of financial prospects, especially after its first run, so he didn't bother to copyright it.
Oops!
Yeah, this film has been in the public domain pretty much since it came out.
That's
why people have been able to get copies of it of, shall we say, varying qualities for the last 60 years.
That's why we had all those Saturday morning cartoons from Little Shop of Horrors, and why we had all those comic books.
There was one.
There
we'll
was?
We'll get to it. I'll get there.
Uh-oh. I'm just making it up.
Nope. Dick Miller, who plays the strange Mr. Fouch who wanders in, really did eat flowers in this movie. When reporters would ask him about it, he would always have some with him, and he'd start eating them right in front of them.
Well, I watched for that, and I will say that I think the initial bites were real, but then later he's lipping them, which, quite honestly, I do not blame him for at all.
Yeah.
Mmm.
Probably one of the reasons this movie is still so well known is it inspired the legendary musical team of Ashman and Menken,
who?
Guys behind the Disney Renaissance.
I never heard of them.
Yeah, to create a musical based on the show in 1982.
There was a what?
Hey, yeah, there was an actual stage musical.
It's almost like we were talking about this 26 minutes ago.
Yep, there was. It was a stage show in London and off-Broadway. And then in 1986, it became a movie, which we mentioned early.
That's deuce and, you say.
And it was an animated series in 1991 called simply Little Shop.
Oh, really?
It lasted about 8 episodes.
That's about 9 too many.
Yes. At the time of the shooting, Jack Nicholson had appeared in 2 films and had worked with Roger Corman as the lead in The Crybaby Killer.
Mm.
According to Nicholson, quote, "I went to the shoot knowing I had to be very quirky because Roger originally hadn't wanted me. In other words, I couldn't play it straight, so I just did a lot of weird stuff that I thought would make it funny." Yes, he did.
Yeah, he did do things that he thought would make it funny.
When Nicholson snuck into one of the showings, he was really kind of surprised by the reaction. The audience was laughing so hard, he couldn't hear the dialogue. As he said, quote, "I didn't quite register it right. It was as if I'd forgotten it was a comedy since the shoot. I got all embarrassed because I'd never really had such a positive reaction before."
Huh. Well, I can understand his confusion, but yeah, we'll come back to that.
When asked where he got the plant, Seymour replies that the seeds were obtained from a Japanese gardener who found the bulb, quote, "in a plantation next to a cranberry farm." This joke is entirely lost on modern audiences. In 1959, it was announced that cranberry crops were tainted with traces of the herbicide, bad stuffium. And as a result, it's a famous additive. And as a result, cranberry sales plummeted. In the stage musical adaptation, and I think in the movie, the plant's origin was changed to become a hybrid between a Venus flytrap and an avocado.
Audience. The joke was because of a
tainted cranberry crop.
Oh, now I get.
Yep. I know. Careful! Don't split your sides too hard.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, Charles B. Griffith, who was Corman's co-writer and was willing to admit it on this film, stood off screen, providing the voice of Audrey Jr. as a reference for the actors and actresses. The voice of the plant was supposed to be done by another actor in post, but what's post? Keep flailing. But Griffith's vocalization of the plant got laughs, and Roger Corman was noted to be a tad cheap.
What?
So he just used Griffith's voice.
Ah, I see. Final print. The reason that the plant sounds like it's being voiced off screen is because the plant
is literally being voiced by a guy standing off screen. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, Corman.
The scene in which a character portrayed by Robert Coogan is run over by a train was accomplished by persuading the railroad crew to back the locomotive away from the actor, and then they printed it in reverse.
Okay, I honestly totally fell for that. I'm like, did they literally just tell him, no, go, run in front of the train, it'll be fine.
No, not quite that bad, but okay. Wait till you find out how they got to use the train yard. The name of the character is Siddhi Shiva, the woman whose relatives are always dying.
Oh, the funeral lady, yeah.
Yeah, is a pun from the phrase sitting Shiva, which is a Jewish funerary rite.
Ah.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
My
wacky
side.
Jewish funeral rites. They do use they reference the Shiva family in the stage musical, even though none of them show up.
Wacky Jewish funeral rites.
Yep. A lot of the comical dialogue, that should be in quotes, between Mushnick and Fouch was ad-libbed.
Oh.
Yeah.
Great.
Now, you remember there's this weird scene at the end, there's a chase scene with Seymour, and he comes out of the subway, and this mob of children come running out with him.
Yeah.
Apparently, Griffith and Wells paid a group of children $0.05 apiece to run out of a subway tunnel.
Okay.
Just They also were able to persuade winos to appear as extras for 10 cents apiece.
Okay. I actually wondered if they knew they were on film because and I was willing to bet they didn't.
The winos would get together, two or three of them, and buy pints of wine for themselves.
They sell wine also, and pints? Oh, Maison de Velour.
Exactly. please don't say... Oh, God. I'm sorry. I threw up in my mouth a little.
Here, can I get you a fifth of wine?
Ah! Good boy. Yep. Put in a quart bottle. They also... According to Griffith, we also had a couple of the winos act as ramrods, sort of like production assistants, and put them in charge of other wino extras.
There were wino wranglers.
There were wino wranglers, yep. Okay. Griffith and Wells also persuaded a funeral home to donate a hearse and coffin with an actual corpse inside for the film shoot.
Which you can't even see.
No. They were able to use the nearby Southern Pacific Transportation Company yard for an entire evening with a payment of 2 bottles of scotch.
Hope it was good scotch, although knowing Corman,
probably not. I'm sure it was also sold in pints.
It's J&B Light. Cutty Sark. Diet Cutty Sark.
House Velour Whiskey. Yes. Mac Velour. Mac Velour is single malt.
There's no brand. It just says scotch. There's nothing else in the label. Just
according to Jack Nicholson, about the scene when he's in the dentist's office, quote, "We never did shoot the end of the scene. This movie was pre-lit. You'd go in, plug in the lights, roll the camera, and shoot. We did the take outside the office and went inside the office, plugged in, lit, and rolled. Jonathan Hayes," that's Seymour, "was up on my chest, pulling my teeth out. Not for real, I'm pretty sure. And in the take, he leaned back and hit the rented dental machinery with the back of his leg and it started to tip over. Roger Corman didn't even call cut. He leapt onto the set, grabbed the tilting machine and said, 'Next set, that's a wrap.'" Yeah.
Good old Corman.
Good old the Corman. During a scene in which Charles Griffith plays the robber toward the end, he remembers that when Mel Wells and I forgot my lines, I improvised a little, but then I was the writer, I was allowed to.
Sure.
Now, Mel Wells states that absolutely none of it was ad-libbed. Every word in Little Shop was written by Chuck Griffith, and I did 98 pages of dialogue in 2 days. Uh-huh. Now, there are no characters really cited in the credits on the film. Ever. So there's been a lot of debate in very significant quarters, I'm sure, about what Seymour's last name actually is. According to the screenplay, it's Krelboind.
Krelboind?
It was changed. Krelboind. B-O-I-N-E-D. It was changed to Krelborn for the 1982 stage musical, which was also held on into the movie and the animated series. Jack Nicholson's character does not appear in the stage musical, but a similar character was added back into the musical remake, played quite ably by Bill Murray. There's a lot of other stuff that happened. This whole movie was quite a thing. Do you have anything I missed?
No, not really. It's like, it's an hour and 12 minutes or something like that. Yeah. So we don't need any more trivia than that. But nope. I'm sure people would love for you to tell them a little story. So tell them a little story.
I will tell them once upon a
time. If they're still there.
Poor schlub Seymour Krelboind, apparently, works in a Skid Row flower shop run by the comically and not terribly specifically ethnic Mr. Gravis Mushnik, who has Greek first name and Jewish last name.
Is he in the Russian looking for moose and squirrel?
I think he's looking for moose and squirrel, yes. Okay. Also with fellow plant enthusiast Audrey, who inexplicably has a crush on Seymour, and also seems to think she's Judy Holliday, crossed with Mrs. Malaprop.
Oh.
Seymour, after repeatedly demonstrating that he is the Gilligan of the florist world by randomly destroying items, is about to be fired, but offers up a strange new plant that he's bred. A flower-eating customer, no, really, suggests to Mushnik that such a plant could bring customers in, so Mushnik ethnically agrees. Trouble is, the plant is failing and can only be nourished by blood. So Seymour obligingly stabs himself to feed the ever-hungry plant, which grows in size, develops to the ability to speak, kinda.
Off camera.
And eventually, as every plant does, develops mind control powers. I had a philodendron like that. It got really awkward. I spent so much money on plant food.
You almost got married.
Eventually, Seymour begins committing murder to keep his botanical buddy fed. First, he accidentally kills the world's worst railroad cop. Then he kills his dentist in self-defense, mind you. And who really hasn't had the same urge?
Mean.
As the bodies pile up, a couple of strangely familiar cops named Frank and Joe are on the trail. Not Hardy, either. Things come to a head at the flower shop when the plant itself gives Seymour away and he runs off into a very Corman-esque chase scene. In the end, Seymour returns to confront the plant and tries to destroy it, only to become its final bad visual effect. The end. The film.
Wow. So not giving anything away, huh?
Nope. I am a mystery wrapped in an enigma.
Sure. I think it's a sock and it has your name on it.
Yes. Yep. Both of them do.
Yeah. One of them's backwards, though. So what was the first time you saw this?
Oh, boy. I actually saw this in, I think, one of these little indie film theaters. Like, I think it was the Off the Wall.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Then I showed it once in a movie marathon.
You are mean.
Oh, yeah, oops. Well. What about you?
I don't know. I know I've seen it. I think I actually used to own a copy on VHS because you could find things like this at local comic conventions and stuff. And it would be like, of course, in this case, it wasn't even illegal because no copyright. Nope.
No. Yep.
I swear it must have been after the musical came out because I don't know that there would have been a reason to see it otherwise.
Yeah.
And nor an opportunity because even local UHF stations that had limited budgets for obtaining films and stuff probably wouldn't have bothered with this.
One of the few places I think I saw this was in It Came From Hollywood. I think they reference it.
I don't remember it being in that film. Don't you? Didn't have wide release.
Yeah, true.
In fact, I don't know, at least in the theater, I don't know anybody besides you and me who saw that when it came out, because it was 70s, but anyway.
Yeah.
Do we want to talk about the actors?
Oh, I suppose we should. The what now? Yeah. Oh, you mean Jack Nicholson. Oh, yeah.
Oh, sure, because...
So there's one.
Start wherever you want.
No, let's... Okay, we'll start with Jonathan Hayes as Seymour.
Sure.
Who is doing probably the world's worst Jerry Lewis I've ever seen. Well, and this includes mine.
It's more like he was doing Jewy Lewis, right?
Yeah. Well, that is Jerry Lewis.
And the news.
And the news, yes. Your fellas, you're just
a whole different
kind
of band you want to hear. Okay, see, that was as bad as his...
A new drug I want.
With little wings. wow, we are so
jeez, getting deeper and deeper.
He is...
there.
Yeah. Yeah.
He exists.
Here's the thing. I don't think he's really, his acting skill is really out of sync with the rest of the film.
No, he fits.
Yeah. So I think I'm going to give him an adequate because I don't think he's a good actor, but I don't think, well, yeah, whatever. You'll figure it out.
All right. What about Jackie Joseph? Who plays Audrey?
I literally do not remember her at all.
I thought she was at least trying. She was kind of doing Judy Holliday, but she's doing that Mrs. Malaprop thing of using the wrong words, you know.
You said it's she's kind of Jewing.
I did not.
You totally did.
Oh, dear. Well, he see, now I got that. My head stuck in it. Yes, I can say that because I have a Jewish friend.
You're my Jewish friend.
Own best friend.
Yeah, well, that's true. Anyway. Him and his socks. Anyway.
Yep.
Sure.
Don't listen to the Mr. Socky. no, she's trying, and she's Again, she fits the movie.
Yeah.
Mel Wells is really, I got to say, he's the guy who plays Mushnick. He's really trying.
Yes.
I mean,
he's doing his best Vincent Gardenia.
Yeah.
He's, I'm guessing, I don't know. I'm looking at the name, and that's all I can judge on, but I'm guessing he is not Jewish.
No, I think he may have seen one once.
Maybe he had a knish.
Yeah, maybe
or something. Sure. If you want to be that, if I can get a pass for Jonathan Hayes, you can get one for Mel Wells.
Yeah. You know, Dick Miller, who is pretty much, apart from Nicholson, the only actor in this who really went on to have a career.
Admittedly, a lot of them having something to do with low budget and or Corman films.
But. A lot of them. But he's been on every TV show at some point.
Yeah. He's
the
character's pointless. There's literally
Doesn't make any sense.
No. That's why they wrote him out, so.
Yeah.
Sure. He eats carnations and he's fine.
He eats flowers. That's his entire character.
Yeah.
Or that's his running joke.
Sure.
And what about the?
I know. Pick somebody. Does it matter?
Well, I know. I can barely say the name. Wally Campo and Jack Warford as Sergeant Joe Fink and Detective Frank Stooley.
Yeah, I totally didn't get it. What was that about?
I mean, he introduces the movie. You know.
I know.
I'm Sergeant Joe Fink. Yeah. And I still don't get what is supposed to, I assume, be a joke. You know, my name's Sergeant Joe Fink. I'm a Fink.
Great. You totally don't get who he's supposed to be doing?
No, I get. I don't get that joke. What do you mean? I'm a Fink. What? What is he? Is that supposed to be another term for cop? I don't know. Rudy, get a hold of yourself.
When in doubt, groan. I mean, it was just a weird Dragnet ripoff, or I should say parody, which very interesting. I think literally the day after the first episode of Dragnet was on the radio, there was some sort of parody. Like Jack Webb got parodied. I remember there's one called Dragonnet, which was done by Stan Freeberg.
Oh, God, yep.
Way, way back. He's just one of those people that just was instantly parodied. And he was in 1960, we don't even have. Well, we had the original Dragnet TV show, I think, had come out, because that was late 50s.
Yeah, it came in early 50s. It came out, I looked it up, in 51.
Well, was that the TV show or the radio show? Because the radio show...
I think that was
the
TV show.
...came out first. But then there was a late 50s TV show, and then we got Dragnet 1969 or whatever when he teamed up with Harry Morgan, which quite honestly was a much better choice. But yeah, I don't know why we're going on about this. They are... Yeah,
it's a bad gag that goes nowhere.
They're adequate minus...
Yeah, they are less than adequate. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And then we might as well mention Jack Nicholson.
Sure.
Who, again, is kind of dragged down by the material, but he's really throwing himself into it.
Yeah.
He just goes full on creepy and he nails it.
Well, and you might also say in some ways that he would never leave that performance, that he would base a lot of his career on it, because he's doing his best, Jack, and he's jumping up and down and googling eye at the camera and stuff. And sure, if you're a Jack Nicholson completist, you have to see this, because it's almost kind of as early as he gets. So
when the movie was released on VHS or even later on DVD, they made a big deal of putting his name and his face all over the cover.
Of course,
he's on screen for about 5 minutes, and maybe.
And they wrote him out of the musical. They brought him back for the movie, but they wrote him out because his character doesn't really add anything.
Honestly, the whole dentist sequence doesn't, but we'll get to that.
Yeah. So I'm going to go with the cast in general ranges from adequate to adequate minus. So this is a cheap, cheap film and it shows. Speaking of
it
which.
It really does.
What's with the film group? Who's that? This was an American International.
I do not know.
I don't either, because he always worked for AI. That was the thing.
And then they must have given him some money.
And then we get that weird, like, cartoon opening with the beat music, which apparently I read actually was the same music from Bucket of Blood.
I believe it. Well, they had just finished Bucket of Blood literally the day before.
Yeah.
And they used a bunch of the same, as Corman did so often, they used a bunch of the same sets and the same props. I saw at least one bucket.
And I guess there's blood in it. The composer apparently, when asked to write music for a new Corman film, he would just repackage the old one.
And no one noticed.
Apparently Corman didn't notice or didn't care. So I haven't seen Bucket of Blood. But apparently the music is from there a lot. Yeah. So one of my first notes here is, so Jewish. What do you think about that? This is obviously meant to be, you know, the famous Jew quarter of L.A.
Oh, yeah. This isn't L.A. This is supposed to be Skid Row, which is, in fact, where it was filmed.
In L.A.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
This is L.A. Skid Row, even though it feels very much like New York.
It's very clearly supposed to be New York.
What do you think about the whole, we're so Jewish here, and the whole thing?
It was part of the times. I mean, they were still doing that.
Yeah.
And it's honestly, apart from his slight obsession with money, Mr. Mushnick isn't as much of a parody, as a cliche as he could have been. Also, why, at one point, I'm not so sure he's entirely supposed to be entirely Jewish. So at one point he says, here lies Seymour Krelborn in Arabic. Suggesting maybe he's Arabic.
That's the only thing that does.
Well, Gravis is not a Jewish first name.
That's fine. I think, I don't know. I was sort of like, I didn't realize this film was meant to be so much playing up on the quote-unquote Jewish humor.
He's not the only one either.
No, everybody
Shiva
is. Yeah.
Is who I think at least that actor was actually Jewish.
Sure.
But, yeah.
That explains it.
It's crude, it's a little offensive, but quite honestly, it's sort of like being assaulted with a damp sock. It's like,
with your name on it?
Yes, with my name on it, because at least then I'll remember.
How did you watch this, just out of curiosity? Where did you go to watch it?
I went to Canopy, the public library video system.
How was your print?
It was all right.
Mine was terrible, and I rented it. Here's the thing. Wow. I started watching a free V or whatever version of it, and there were commercials, and of course they were so badly placed. The problem was that their print was way better than the one that I actually rented. I got to the first commercial, and I was like, I can't do this, and I went and rented it, and it was and this is on Apple. Sorry, but the print on Apple stinks.
I don't think there is a terribly good print of it. I mean, they didn't care enough about it to copyright it. He probably didn't do much in terms of preservation.
I didn't look to see if it's in the Criterion Collection. Would not surprise me. The blob's there.
The blob's different. The blob was actually kind of significant. It shaped a lot of the monster movies.
Sure. I disagree. There's no man in a suit. I got to say, though, the way this is shot. Okay, we got to remember, this film came out the same year as last week's film. Last week's film was 1960.
Well, that's not unusual. Corman would put out 3-4 films a year.
Oh, that's not the point I'm making. The point I'm making is if you look at this film and you look at that film, would you just guess they were made by the same person?
I would not. I honestly would not.
I actually felt the way it was shot felt like it was going to be a play or had been a play. Not least of which, because, they only had two sets, see? And then outside, I honestly could hear Ed Wood going, quick, grab the camera! Because the fact that they paid the winos surprised me. I honestly thought nobody knew.
Yeah. I'm sure the city didn't know. I'm sure they didn't get permission to run around those junkyards.
Oh, no. Not if you have to shoot in 2 days. No.
Yeah, no.
There's a weird directorial dichotomy to me between the interior and exterior scenes. The interior scenes are shot, here's that word again, adequately. There's nothing particularly interesting about the camera angles or whatever. Apparently,
the camera hardly moves, really.
Well, apparently, he actually took a cue from television, and he had two cameras set up at every point, so he wouldn't have to reshoot things. Yeah, he could just cut back and forth between the two bits of footage, but the interior stuff is fairly plainly shot. Again, it felt very play-like to me. And outside, especially during that weird-ass chase scene at the end, I'm like, is this some sort of French expressionist film? Or do I feel ennui? Is my clove cigarette giving me visions? I don't know.
Am I suddenly wearing a beret? I'm not sure.
It was almost like there was an attempt at doing something artistic or interesting when they were doing the chase scene. It just didn't actually spill over into the rest of the movie.
Yeah. It is shot very differently, and it has a different feel, even a different pacing.
Yeah.
But some of the dialogue in this, I mean, never mind all of the fake Yiddishisms. What am I, a philatelist?
Well, and there's a sign.
He's trying to say philanthropist.
Well, there's a sign right in the beginning that says, "We didn't let you spend so much." And I think you have to say it that way because that's how it's written. There's a couple of other quotes that I actually kind of liked vaguely. One of the ones, it grows like a cold sore on the lips.
I have that one written down,
and
too.
And it's monstrositous. And
I kind of like when he's talking about Hawaii, like, aloha, oi.
Yeah, that one hurt. There's another one where it's like, oh, it's a finger of speech, you know. I could eat a hearse. I actually did like that one.
Oh, dear.
They don't exactly induce laughter, except when we do it.
Yeah, honestly, it's more fun to quote them afterwards than to actually watch them.
Yeah.
When you're watching them, you're like, oh, God, really?
And then there's some continuity issues. Like, for example, the store seems to be more or less bereft of flowers while open, and yet when closed, seems to have tons
of
them.
Full of flowers! Tons of them! Yep.
So I think there's a slight business approach here he might want to change. Like, don't
restock after your I didn't realize there was such a thing as plant groupies.
I guess...
You know, these two teenage girls who, fawn all over Seymour because he's created this giant, weird-ass plant.
Yeah. I guess they were just there because of the Tournament of Roses parade or some. Of course, they don't want roses, which is fine. I don't care. I don't know why they're there either.
Yeah.
They're literally, you know why they're there? They are there to inspire somebody to come by, make something better out of this, and say, you know what? If there was a third one, there could be a Greek chorus, and it could be these three black women, and they're really awesome, and they really help move the story along.
And we give them a couple of really cool songs, kind of doo-wop groups.
That's why they're there, because he knew it wasn't what he was making now. It's what somebody else would make later.
Yeah. There are definitely parts you understand why they didn't bring them in the show. The whole thing with Seymour's mother, the hypochondriac,
it does add nothing.
It adds nothing. I can't say it drags the movie down because it's already as far down as it can pretty much get.
Yeah, but
it grinds everything to a halt.
It does add something. I can't believe you missed this.
Oh yes,
it adds footage.
True. Pat, the film. Yeah.
Well, and also, let's face it, the dentist has no connection to the shop in this movie. He's not the boyfriend.
That's right.
He just suddenly, Seymour has to go to a dentist.
He just happens to be both Mushnick and Seymour's dentist.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
And he does. He is a customer. He orders three flowers for his display.
Right, but otherwise, I mean, that's it. It's the most tenuous of connections, and it's... Yeah. And also, let's face it, what motivation does Seymour have? The plant talks to him. Okay, personally, I would have picked it up and flushed it, but that's...
Yeah. You know,
it doesn't actually seem to have any kind of powers. It doesn't...
Initially, though, it keeps him from getting fired.
Yeah, but... After that, the motivation for Seymour is kind of all over the place. It doesn't, especially when it comes to actually killing somebody.
Well, the two deaths he originally has, the two people he kills, one is an accident and one is kind of self-defense.
Kind
of. The dentist. And then suddenly, the plant turns into Dracula. And you're like, sleep!
Set to the characters of the audience. Oops.
Yeah.
Well, and then we have... Okay, let's talk about the special effects. So, the word puppet had not yet been invented. There is this plant, and it's obviously made of plastic because you can hear it clonking together when it talks.
Yep.
Clonk, feed me. And then later, it gets bigger. And it gets worse because now they're not even trying. They just open it and it talks and it's not lip syncing or anything.
Yeah, they're not trying to synchronize the movements with the speech at all.
And then the payoff, the glamour shot, if you will.
The money shot, yes. Yeah,
I could use a Japanese word here, but I won't. but there's a scene where we realize, or it's made plain what has been going on because these little blossoms open up.
Oh, God.
And there's something in them. And thankfully, one of the characters tells us what they are because otherwise we would have no idea.
They're supposed to be the faces of the victims. But yeah, it is the most half-assed effect.
Yeah.
And you know, it's like, sure, it's 1960, but come on.
Why didn't they just literally put a flower headdress around the actors, maybe paint their faces white or something, and have them do that?
Which is what they did in the stage show, by the way.
I know, and it made a lot more sense. Not at least so they could continue singing.
Yeah.
So not... And also the ending doesn't really do anything.
No, it also makes no sense. Why did all of a sudden do all the buds die?
We
don't know, because it's just been... It did, and they just ate Seymour.
Yeah, and he pops out instantly. And
apparently he can still talk, because he says his favorite catchphrase, "I didn't mean to." Because remember how that was on all the t-shirts and the hats?
Oh, I used to get my "I didn't mean to" Diet Coke glass.
Oh, yeah.
And my "I didn't mean to" jockstrap. Yeah, the ending, it almost, you could hear the scissors coming out and cutting. We're out of film. Okay, done. Let's move on to the next feature. Yeah, it's, I gotta say, though, do you know of an example before this one where somebody tries to mix comedy and horror?
That's the thing. That is the one thing I will say about this movie. I have not. I can't think of any.
Okay. If anybody else has...
Are there any that came out before 1960 where they were trying to be funny and scary at the same time?
Trying. Not happened to work out that way, but actually trying.
Yeah, and this was intentionally supposed to be funny.
Yeah, and to be fair, it's not a huge subgenre now, but there's some great examples of it. What Do We Do in the Shadows is probably the number one I can think of.
Which that's is a good one.
It works. It can really work.
The Bruce Campbell Evil Dead movies.
Yeah, but the Twilight series.
Yep. Oh, hey, wait a minute. You said intentional.
Oh, right. That's true. So,
Jacob. there's a bunch of them.
Yeah. So I don't know if there's another attempt before this. And if it's not, I will give this movie that. But I also have to note that, strangely, we're nearly out of time. Do you have anything quick you want to get in there before?
I did want to mention that one of the weirder sequences to me is the one with the streetwalker. Leonora, who keeps when Seymour is out in his hypnotic daze, which Jonathan Hayes portrays by walking around with his mouth slightly open and walking only in straight lines.
You have to admit, his mouth is very, very slightly open.
It is indeed. And she just starts coming on to him and keeps dropping her handkerchief and basically has targeted him. And my question is, why? Does he look like a good mark?
He looks like a Doctor Who fan from... Yeah. Although, is that pre-Doctor Who? It might be. He has the scarf.
I can't remember how old that show is.
Yeah. She needed to be potential food, I guess, and that was...
I guess, but it was just weird.
Yeah.
Funny weird, just weird.
Yeah. But other than that, what else is weird is that we're out of time. Where did the time go? Socks.
I don't know.
The Finish.
So, Max.
Yes?
You saw this at some point somewhere in a thing.
Several times, I think. I remember Riff Trax did it a long time ago. I think I saw that.
So, what you're saying is, having seen it so many times, this is a film that you really like.
This film is kind of like, you know, when you're a kid and you wrap a rubber band around your finger and watch it turn purple, and then you take it off, and it feels good because it doesn't hurt anymore. It's kind of like that.
Except more Jewish!
More Jewish! It's more like putting a kosher rubber band around your finger! Oy!
All right, depends how you kill it.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, this movie is terrible. This is really an example of one of the reasons people don't respect Roger Corman.
Mm.
I mean, the people who worked with him still like him. Apparently, the people who worked on this movie with him loved him. But this movie is bad. And how could it not be if it's shot in 2 days?
I bet that there are people out there that could shoot a film in 2 days and it would be good.
I'm sure now that they have like digital photography and it's easier to do, I bet you could.
Mm.
But this ain't one of them.
Did you think it was funny at all?
Once in a while, I thought... Dick Smith was kind of funny, and I thought when he's interacting with Mushnick, I thought that was kind of cute, there are a lot of scenes that are like, okay, that's close to funny. It's in Funny's backyard, you know, peeing on its plants, but that's really about it. What about you? You've seen this once?
Maybe twice. I don't remember. Mm-hmm. I think I did see it earlier, a long time ago. Don't remember. Mm-hmm. It's not good. It's not funny. I forgot that it was supposed to be. I actually did forget that part.
Oh, really?
Halfway through, I forgot that part.
It was supposed to be a comedy.
This is a film that has been directed towards comedy. When it gets to the exit, it's been then detoured around it and never quite gets back to where it needs to be for comedy. Just like that joke.
Yeah.
Which is fine.
I think that actually sums it up pretty well.
Remember me and metaphors. No. No, it's not. I guess I can understand it being this sort of New York Jewish thing, even though it's quite obviously shot not in New York palm trees. And The thing that amazes me is that Ashman and Menken came by later and said, oh, we have hit gold and there's no copyright. We are making a musical.
That was actually a major reason for it, is it cost them nothing to use the
The only sad part about this, and I didn't realize this was a thing, is that the original show, which ran over 2,200 performances off Broadway, ran off Broadway, which meant it wasn't eligible for a Tony, but it won tons of like Critics Circle Awards stuff, all that stuff. And let's face it, you and I were damned lucky and just never knew it. We saw the original run in London in 1985.
Yes.
And we probably did see Ellen Green, because apparently she played in that version as well.
And I remember seeing the movie and thinking, oh my God, Ellen Green is like, she's doing a great impression of whoever we saw in London.
Yeah.
So I think it might have been her.
Yeah. And that show's fun.
Really is.
They took, quite honestly, garbage. And they made, there's great songs. I mean, it's Menken and Ashman. Of course the songs are great. It's sort of a pay on to 50s doo-wop and other 50s styled music, which works great, especially when Steve Martin pops in as, of course they didn't originally have Steve Martin, but he pops in and he's doing his best Elvis for the Son Be a Dentist song. How, besides the lack of copyright, they saw this film and thought, we can make something out of this, I don't know. Because I honestly think if they didn't, this film would have been forgotten.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true.
And it justifiably so.
Maybe Corman scholars would have held on to it, but that's about it.
And it's weird because there's these attempts at something a little bit like the opening, that weird, really long cartoon that we're looking at is actually kind of neat. And I'm like, oh, is this like, should we know who this artist is? Did they end up becoming somebody? Or I don't know. And they've got this beat music going on, which was, of course, very big at the time. And again, the way that the chase scene is shot really made me think of some of like the French cinema verite or the new wave stuff that's all like meant to feel very truthful. And then we get back inside and it's like, oh, good. Lucy and Desi have left for the day, so we can use their set. And also just like, who decided this was a great idea for a film? I know, a talking plant that eats people. Let's shoot it. It'll be funny. I don't get it. So,
nope, that is a mystery.
I would say that for the core man, this is a film that you could miss and it would be fine. Being said, if you're wondering where the musical came from, you can watch it. And honestly, just watch the musical. The musical's a lot more fun.
Seriously, just watch that. But before you watch that, you'll need to answer our poll question.
Please.
Which is there a movie adaptation you've seen that is better than the source material? I wonder what inspired that. If so, which one? If not, why not? And you can answer this by emailing us at us@maxmikemovies.com. You can also go to our website, maxmikemovies.com, and leave a maxmikemovies.comment. See what I did there?
Yes, you got yourself fired again.
I'm developing a thick callus over my hired fired muscle.
It only amazes me it took you 290 episodes to come up with that.
I'm a slow healer. You can also find us on the Foxbacks.
Facebook.
Backs Fox.
Facebook!
Whatever. Bumpy. Under Max Mike Movies. And you can find us on literally every podcast app that is created anywhere in the multiverse throughout all time and space, blah-da-doo-da-day.
Uh-huh.
But We are just getting started with Being Like the Core Man.
Yes.
Tell us, Mike, how next can we be like the Core Man?
No. They'll just have to tune in. No, I'm not telling.
What? You can't do that. We have to hook them. We have to bring them in. You know, tease them a little bit. What's it going
to
be?
I am putting a big X on your wish for me to tell you the film. A big fat X. The Man with X-Ray Eyes, which is next week's film.
Okay, now you're fired, so I don't know who's going to do the show next week.
X, The Man with X-Ray Eyes, starring Ray Milland, as you've never seen him before.
With only one head?
I wish. Yes, he's distinctly without Rosie Greer.
And if
you don't know the reference, more power to you.
Yeah.
So yes, don't X us out next week. Instead, join us for X.
To me, my X-Men.
Yeah, there's none of that in this either. Join us next week for X, The Man with the X-Ray Eyes, not secretly the brother of Speed Racer.
Aw.
This has been a co-production of The Voice of Max and The Movie Wrench.